Namaste. What a long week. Can you feel the cumulative effect? Is this what you expected? I was thinking about this, and I remember one of my favorite cartoons, Gary Larson cartoon. There's a dog sitting in the back seat of a car, and he's talking to the dog in the driveway of the next house over. And he says, "Hey Ralph, I'm going to the vet to get tutored." Feel a little bit like that dog. Reminds me, years back, I called my best friend from college and I said, "I'm going to a month-long meditation retreat. You should join me. It'll be fun." We're going to get tutored. I want to talk a little bit tonight about the fruit of the practice and what happens when we begin to settle the mind and feel the heart. The fruit of the practice can be called the awakening of the mind and heart, of bodhicitta. The flowering of the two qualities that we've talked a lot about this week, the awakening of wisdom and the awakening of compassion. These are the two wings that allow you to fly. They're the two eyes that allow you to see into the depth of things. These two questions: what's happening right now? And can I be with this? These are the ways that we can intimately and with kindness investigate into how you're holding your experience, and truly, ultimately, into the nature of reality. So the word dharma, or dhamma, depending if you're using Sanskrit or Pali, it means the truth, the way of things. And these two wings are what help you to see into the nature of things, into the truth of your own life, and into the truth of what's possible in your life. And they require a sense of balance. You can have all the compassion in the world, but have no skill for working with an issue when it's present. And you may have clear insight, but no access to compassion or kindness or empathy. When both are fully developed, as I've heard it said, awakening or enlightenment is inevitable. So this week you've been strengthening both wings. You've been developing concentration. You've been coming back again and again to your intention. You've been developing a fair bit of will. You've been working with the instructions. You've been calming the mind. You've been seeing into the reality of things. You haven't left. You've also been practicing metta. You've been practicing self-compassion. You've been checking in and asking and listening to what's needed in the moment. And to whatever degree you have been able to, you've been practicing being gentle with yourself. So wisdom is usually translated as panya. It's common sense or intelligence. As it develops, it can be called discernment or insight. And as you may have noticed, when you dive into practice, it reveals discernment not just into the Buddha's teachings, but into the meaning of the teachings. You begin to see into the nature of impermanence. You begin to see day after day how everything is changing. And you begin to see into the nature of suffering itself, that your relationship to what is changing determines the degree to which you will suffer. And you begin to see into the nature of the self, of who you are. And perhaps you've had times of feeling the sense of I and mine very, very tight. And you may have had moments or periods of time where the sense of I and mine sort of falls away. And that sense of spacious, effortless awareness is available for you. And again, I'm sure you've seen how you get caught and how you can let go and how you can get free. So tonight, I'd like to talk a little bit about compassion. It's such a privilege to be in this seat. I have been a participant on retreats and blessed to be serving in this way. And to day after day be witness to your courage, to the sincerity, to the authenticity, to the deep desire to see into the nature of things, the reality of things. It's the best game in town. It really is. Buddhism tells us that you are the inheritor of your karma, that you are the product of causes and conditions. It also says you're the creator of your karma. And you're probably familiar with genes, you know, the genetic code that is handed down through generation to generation to generation that has made up this body that you're walking around in. This is part of your karmic inheritance. Your body with its tendencies, with its strengths, with its weaknesses. And you're probably familiar with memes. Memes are the stories, the beliefs, the sense of how we hold our life that are also handed down from generation to generation to generation. We take on the culture in which we're raised. We tend to take on beliefs without realizing we've even taken them on. It's such a powerful experience for me, in particular when I might be working with someone who is struggling with a very, very deep issue. And part of that struggle is a recognition of how much of that, of the beliefs that are holding that experience are sort of inherited by through parents or through family. That recognition of the suffering that we experience kind of in our family structure goes back for generations and generations and generations. And that powerful recognition that is possible to not hand that down to the next generation. That karmic pattern, if you will, can stop through wisdom, through recognizing it, and through compassion, that deep practice of meeting that suffering with an open heart. It's a miracle, and it's a mystery of how that works. And I imagine that during this week, you have felt that mystery at different times. Something that may have touched you. Some moment that may have felt kind of boundless or immeasurable. And Tara kind of guided us into that inquiry last night and this morning, that sense of just sort of stilling the mind and looking back at awareness itself. Or to feel the boundless quality of the heart in some moment. And this is a taste of what are called the Brahmaviharas, the immeasurable states. The immeasurable quality of kindness, of compassion, the boundless capacity you have for joy and for equanimity. Did you ever watch a puppy or a small child just suddenly get excited and run around? You know, I think of them as happy attacks, you know. You see, a dog just gets a happy attack. And sometimes they seem to come out of nowhere. And just as our suffering can come out of nowhere, occasionally we just have that glimpse of the mystery, of this infinite, boundless state that we experience not just in our awareness, but in our heart as well. And chances are, while you may have touched into those boundless states, you may have felt the opposite as well. A sense of a critic, a sense of just this ruthless voice in the back of your head. Never enough. The experience of cruelty. And hopefully, if you felt cruelty this week, it was not externally. But you were aware of that cruel inner voice. Cruelty actually seeks to do harm. And the truth is, we see it everywhere in the world. The wiping out of indigenous cultures. It's happening right now on this planet. Slavery and the roots of racism. It's happening right now. Homophobia and violence against women. It's happening. The polarization that we're experiencing in our culture right now around this election, which you will be visiting in the near future, it's happening right now. And so we encounter this cruelty externally. We see it. And we feel it. And we feel that cruelty turned on ourselves, by ourselves. So what's the antidote to cruelty? Well, the antidote to cruelty is compassion. But when we look at compassion, we can perhaps see how simple and profound a practice it is. But at the same time, it can be utterly difficult to practice compassion. Utterly difficult to cultivate it. This fundamental quality of compassion is so easily obscured and unavailable to us. And why is that? Well, as you know, there are these forces that take you away from being present in the heart and in the mind. The three poisons of greed and hatred and delusion. We've all been treated to that experience. The five hindrances. These weather systems that come through at random times, the clouds of aversion and anger and ill will. The moments when you are lost in fantasy or craving or wanting or planning. Lost in that endless cycle of anxiety and worry. Or the experience of sloth and torpor, the numbness, not being able to touch into what's here. Or the paralysis of doubt and fear. Another one of the forces that's articulated in the Buddhist tradition are the eight worldly winds. And I find these so interesting. We think about navigating through life, these winds that are blowing you all the time. These eight worldly winds are the desire for pleasure and the fear of pain. The desire for praise and the fear of blame. The desire for fame and the fear of ill repute. The desire for gain and the fear of loss. All these forces, these turbulent forces, are what pulls us away from our true nature, from an open, clear mind, an open, clear heart. And it is such a challenge to establish equanimity. There's a little story that I believe comes from China. And the story is, it's a well-known scholar, an academic, who started practicing meditation. And he kind of befriended a meditation teacher. And he had this insight. And he wrote a poem. And the poem said, "Unmoved by the eight worldly winds, serenely I sit on the purplish gold terrace." Well, he loved this poem and he gave it to his servant who took it across the river to deliver it to the meditation teacher. The meditation teacher, he read the poem, kind of rolled his eyes. And I'm not making it up. This is where it comes from. And with a paintbrush, he writes the word fart on the letter. It's delivered back to the scholar. His academic reads it, and he's incensed. And he comes over and he starts cursing out the meditation teacher for being so rude. And the meditation teacher says, "You said you're no longer moved by the eight worldly winds, but one little fart brings you across the river." And you know how that is when you're just feeling great. It's like, oh, I've arrived. And then you're gone. Just like that. The wind comes and you're blown off balance. How many times have you been lost, kind of wandering in the past and the future? And yet, every time you get lost, eventually, you wake up. Some factor becomes aware, and you return back to the here and now. Sometimes you come back with a sense of judgment. Sometimes you might come back with a sense of understanding, a sense of compassion for yourself, compassion for the mind. So compassion is a feeling. It's a feeling in the heart. And compassion is an actual desire to alleviate harm and to bring it to an end. I'd like to talk a little bit about how you can cultivate this quality. Compassion is about meeting the suffering that is there. Meeting the suffering that is there internally when we recognize it inside, and when we meet suffering outside. A story. One day, when I was a freshman in high school, I saw a kid from my class was walking home from school. His name was Kyle. It looked like he was carrying all of his books. I thought to myself, why in the world would anyone bring home all his books on a Friday? He must be a nerd. I had quite a weekend planned, parties and a football game. Let me rewind that. Parties and a football game. With my friends tomorrow afternoon. So I shrugged my shoulders and went on. As I was walking, a bunch of kids were running right toward him. They ran at him, knocked all his books out of his arms, and tripping him, so he landed in the dirt. His glasses went flying, and I saw them land in the grass about 10 feet from him. He looked up, and I saw this terrible sadness in his eyes. My heart went out to him, so I jogged over to him, and as he crawled around looking for his glasses, I saw a tear in his eyes. As I handed him his glasses, I said, "Those guys are jerks. They should really get a life." He looked at me and he said, "Hey, thanks." There was a big smile on his face. It was one of those smiles that showed real gratitude. I helped him pick up his books and I asked him where he lived. And as it turned out, he lived near me. So I asked him why I had never seen him before. He said he had gone to private school before now. I never would have hung out with a private school kid before, but we talked all the way home and I carried some of his books. He turned out to be a really cool kid. I asked him if he wanted to play a little football with my friends. He said yes. We hung out all weekend, and the more I got to know Kyle, the more I liked him, and my friends thought the same. Monday morning came and there was Kyle with a huge stack of books again. I stopped him and said, "You're going to build some serious muscles with this pile of books every day." And he just laughed and he handed me half the books. Over the next 4 years, Kyle and I became best friends. When we were seniors, we began to think about college. Kyle decided on Georgetown, and I was going to Duke. I knew that we would always be friends and that the miles would never be a problem. He was going to be a doctor, and I was going for business on a football scholarship. Kyle was valedictorian of our class. I teased him all the time about being such a nerd, and he had to prepare a speech for graduation, and I was so glad it wasn't me having to get up there and speak. Graduation day, I saw Kyle, and he looked great. He was one of those guys that really found himself during high school. He filled out and actually looked good in glasses. He had more dates than I had, and all the girls loved him. And sometimes I was jealous, and today was one of those days. I could see that he was really nervous about his speech. So I smacked him on the back, and I said, "Hey, big guy, you'll be great." And he looked at me with one of those looks, the really grateful one, and he smiled. As he started his speech, he cleared his throat and he began, "Graduation is a time to thank those who helped you make it through this tough years. Your parents, your teachers, your siblings, maybe a coach, but mostly your friends. And I'm here to tell you that being a friend to someone is the best gift you can give them. I'm going to tell you a story." I just looked at my friend with disbelief as he told me the story of the first day we met. He had planned to kill himself. He talked about how he had cleaned out his locker so his mother wouldn't have to, and he was carrying his stuff home. He looked hard at me and he gave me this little smile. "Thankfully, I was saved," he said. "My friend saved me from doing the unspeakable." I heard a gasp go through the crowd as this handsome, popular boy told us about his weakest moments. I saw his mom and dad looking at me and smiling that same grateful smile. Not until that moment did I realize its depths. Never underestimate the power of your actions. With one small gesture, you can change a person's life. When we really sense another person suffering inside, when we are willing to feel it, and to feel compassion as a verb, as a calling forth to meet that suffering, it has immeasurable consequences. So part of what evokes compassion is the realization of connection, that this is a collective experience. And as we sit together this week, we realize on some level that we are all touched by impermanence. That we are going to lose everyone that we hold dear. We all lose this life and this body. All of us in no particular order. As I reflect on cultivating compassion, it's interesting to see how it's kind of a muscle. It kind of expands and it contracts. The more we look at compassion as a spiritual practice, the more you'll realize when it's not there. The more you'll realize how indifference and apathy and inattention get in the way of feeling compassion. In early July, when I was leading a retreat in New England, we had two large oak trees fall in the house and pretty much wreck a third of the house. We're still rebuilding 4 months later. And it was so touching to feel the compassion when people heard about this. People offering us room in their house, asking if we needed anything. It was so sweet to feel that. But I also noticed something that when people kind of heard about this kind of from further away, you know, because there's the whole derecho kind of came up, and it was a shared experience we all had. But friends on the other coast, they were kind, but I didn't feel the same kind of resonance. And I realized that they didn't relate to it because they didn't go through it. And I noticed for myself how my compassion is in direct relationship to what I can relate to. I can hear about, you know, flooding in Bangladesh, and it doesn't register for me, you know. But if it's someone who's close to me, or if it's me, I'm right there. We can train ourselves to be sensitive to the suffering in the world by starting with our own suffering. When you think about all the moments that you found yourself lost or experiencing that inner critic, that own sense of inner cruelty. Over this last week, the hours that you were captured by all those forces, how many hours were you lost? And the question becomes, can you meet that suffering without resistance? Much of the time, we can't. We experience those barriers of indifference or apathy or inattention, or that ruthless critic simply won't relax. Sometimes, even though we want to be compassionate, it's still not easy to open to what's there. To access genuine compassion is a practice. We notice when we're not feeling compassion, and we can begin to investigate that, which can be tremendously revealing. To actually explore and investigate with kindness that lack of compassion, the lack of empathy, can be quite revealing. So what is genuine compassion? I was thinking about this, and the way my mind works, of course, an old joke popped into my mind. It's the story of this old man at the end of his life, and he's sitting with his best friend, and he says, "I know I only have a little bit of time left, but you've always been there for me, and I just have one final request. I have a case of aged single malt whiskey down in the basement, and I'm wondering if on the anniversary of my death, if you could pour one of those bottles on the grave. They're 10 bottles, so 10 years. And his friend, his eyes filled up with tears, said, "I can do that, and I'll call all of your old best friends around as long as they're alive. And on the anniversary of your death, we will pour that bottle of whiskey on your grave." And they just stood there and looked at each other. And his friend, Lynn, leaned in. He said, "Is it okay if we pass it through our kidneys first?" That's not real compassion. We move from this tight self to that sense of I and mine falling away. I made a joke at lunch wondering if we could make the metta meditation compulsory so I'd be sure to have enough hot water. But when we look at what it means to cultivate genuine compassion for ourselves and for others, it's important to realize that there are times we can't access it. Sometimes it's unavailable to us. Sometimes it's unavailable for others, even though we want to cultivate compassion. The practice is to watch your mind whenever you approach suffering or difficulty, either internally or externally. Whether it be pain in the body, whether it be a painful emotion, a painful relationship, suffering in the world. And do you feel uneasy? Do you push away? Do you distract yourself? The practice is self-observation without judgment. And of course, suffering is everywhere. It can feel overwhelming. A year after grad school, I joined the Peace Corps, and I was in West Africa, in Niger, one of the poorest countries on the planet. And in Niger, along the Niger River, there was an epidemic of river blindness. Because the water wasn't pure, there were the impurities in the water, there would be worms that would actually get into the body, and the worms would make their way up into the brain and into the eyes. So there would be these lines of people guided by small children, and they would sing different Quranic verses for donation. And when you'd get close to them, you could actually see the worms moving in their eyes. Everywhere you would turn, there were lepers, there were just a sea of poverty. It was a challenge to stay open to that. But I took it on kind of as a practice to try and keep my heart open. I had one moment in the market, in the marché, where I was just kind of going along the stalls, kind of tightly packed, and there was a tug on my shirt. And I turned, and there was an older man with a bucket. He had no fingers, but a bucket kind of hanging off the stump of his thumb. And he said, cadeau, monsieur, you know, a gift. And he kind of put his hands right in my face. And I just instinctively just reeled back. And I said, no. And I'll never forget the look in his eyes. He just looked in my eyes and he said, merci. And he turned. And I was just frozen in place by that look in his eyes. And I went to find him because there was just something in that connection, and I couldn't find him. I looked everywhere in the marché. I couldn't find this guy. I made a resolve to not back away, to actually spend time and to kind of hang out with many of these people. It was a fascinating experience to see, and actually I read something by Ram Dass, who he said, imagine if you wanted an incarnation where you got no ego gratification whatsoever, and you could simply watch life go by without any recognition of you as anything special. And he kind of talked about how like in the incarnation of a soul, of how begging is a very, very high state. And I really saw how with a lot of the younger, you know, crippled people, there was a tremendous amount of anger. But with some of the older folks, there was an incredible equanimity, an incredible sweetness that was so powerful for me to experience. And there was also a very powerful experience in that I didn't have enough money to give everyone. It wasn't like there were five or six guys sitting on a corner. This was a country filled with impoverished, malnourished people, more than I could ever possibly connect with. to find a sense of peace with that was a very challenging part of my practice. To not turn away from the very physical suffering, and yet to be as available to it as I could. And that evokes the question, is it possible to be open to all the suffering in the world? This is not just a theoretical or an intellectual question. It's not just limited to a meditation retreat. Here's what Joseph Goldstein had to say about this, which really resonated for me. He said, the practice is about purification and the transformation of your consciousness that makes compassion the default setting in your life. The practice is about purification and the transformation of your consciousness that makes compassion the default setting of your life. This is not an easy task, to have compassion as the default setting. You have to be open. You have to be mindful. You have to cultivate equanimity to be with the suffering without drowning. To hold a sense of equanimity in the midst of all of this, to be open to your own suffering as an opportunity to open and grow. When we practice, we see how quickly, how easily we close down and calcify around a tight sense of self, and how we can possibly open. So it was 1 year ago, during the fall meditation retreat, that my 15-year-old dog died. I don't have children, and I realized that that's about as close to being a parent as I'll ever get. But we spent a lot of time together. And I left the retreat to go home for the day at the very, very end. And on the way back, I felt I couldn't come back. I felt so kind of locked into my own process and didn't feel like I could even open to receive, you know, what was here. But as I was driving back, you know, very, very tight and calcified, something occurred to me. So fundamental. I realized that I wasn't the only person who had lost a dog. I wasn't the only person to lose someone or something close to me. And something softened. And when I got back, the message board was filled with notes, and the empathy and the well-wishing was really quite overpowering. When we shift from the tight self to the shared experience, compassion is a natural byproduct of that. We feel each other's suffering. And we feel each other's joy. I remember once in third grade, there was a very remarkable phenomena. And I remember this from third grade. One kid would throw up, and then another kid would throw up. And then everybody's throwing up. You ever notice that with kids? Like, one kid will cry, and then all the other kids start crying. You know, we have these mirror neurons. We feel each other. We impact each other. One of the keys to being with our suffering, when we are tight and calcified and drawn in, is to remember this phrase, other people feel this too. When we remember that our suffering is not unique, that it is a shared experience, something begins to open. We begin to resonate with others. As our life gets busy, we tend not to take the time to open to another person, to try to understand their experience from their point of view. We tend not to include others. You may have felt this empathic quality while on retreat, even in the midst of silence. I'm always amazed the subtle ways that we influence each other, the subtle ways we touch each other. In a moment of restlessness, you might glance over and see someone deeply still, and there may just be this little recognition of, I can do that too. Or you may have felt someone shuffling and being really restless next to you. And while there may have been maybe a little irritation with that, there may also have been a sense of empathy or compassion for what they might be struggling with. If you may have heard someone in the room sobbing, again, you feel that resonance. It touches you in some way. If you might glance at someone during this last week and just see someone and they look like they're going through hell, again, we resonate. And the question is, how much can we drop from this tight sense of I and mine, from the natural self-absorption that we tend to fall into, to open to another? To remember that in those moments of fear or tightness or suffering, we think we're one lone little wave on the ocean. And we forget that we're connected to all the other waves and that we are, in fact, the ocean. John Friend, the yoga teacher, would tell this story of how when he was in high school, he was a wrestler and, you know, pretty cocky and pretty macho. You know, always kind of looking for some wrong that he could right. And he said he was bicycling home from school one day, and this car just really fast backed out of the driveway right in front of him. And he threw down his bike, and he just went marching around, just ready to really give it to the driver. And there wasn't anyone in the car. It was one of those moments. And kind of the classic example that sort of demonstrates how the mind and heart work is, imagine if you're walking down a crowded sidewalk and you're carrying groceries and someone bumps into your arm and you drop your groceries and they drop their groceries and you turn around in anger and you see that person is blind. How quickly we can move from self-righteous anger to compassion and understanding. So much of how we access compassion is through that practice of empathy, through the practice of sensing what another person's experience is. I thought we might do just a brief reflection. If you like, you can close your eyes. You might bring into mind someone that in your life might be struggling, someone who might be experiencing some difficulty or challenge. And you might take a moment to imagine what they're feeling. If you could slide into their body. Well, what do you imagine they're feeling inside? What do you imagine they are believing? What do you imagine they are wanting or hoping for that they're not getting? Can you sense the unmet need? And imagine simply what it's like to meet their suffering with your awareness and with your heart. And deepening the breath. If you can let the eyes open or remain with the eyes closed. A good friend of mine many years ago was struggling in his life and went to his therapist. His therapist said, "You really need to learn to meditate. You'll feel better." A lot of you know the story. So he got really excited. He got trained in meditation. He went to his retreat. This retreat was filled with sadness, depression, and rage. He went back to his therapist. He said, "What the heck were you talking about? You told me I feel better. But all I could feel was depression and sadness and rage." And his therapist said, "Yeah. You feel sadness better. You feel depression better. You feel anger better." The good news and the bad news in this practice is that you become more sensitive. You become more sensitive to yourself, and you become more sensitive to those around you. And it requires a certain degree of deepening of practice to tolerate that sensitivity. To remember in our relationships that every one of us is struck by those winds of greed, of hatred, of delusion. Every one of us is fighting our own battles. Every one of us, when we're overwhelmed, will revert to some primitive reflex of fight, flight, or freeze. As your compassion grows, there can be at the same time a sense of, in your sensitivity, a growing sense of engagement in the world. If we think of compassion as a verb, as the calling forward to meet the suffering around you, it becomes a very powerful practice. Wendell Berry said, I live my life in widening circles that reach out across the world. I may not ever complete the last one, but I give myself to it fully. All of these traditions, they all speak to how if you want compassion in the world, the only place to begin is with yourself. If there is to be peace in the world, there must be peace among the countries. If there is to be peace among the countries, there must be peace among the cities. If there must be peace among the cities, there must be peace among the neighborhoods. If there is to be peace among the neighborhoods, there must be peace among the families. If there is to be peace among the families, there must be peace inside. And so we begin with ourselves. I've oftentimes heard criticism of this practice as being narcissistic, as navel-gazing. The way I view it is the analogy of that phrase, "My cup runneth over." And you know that experience when you're just so filled with energy and goodwill that you can't not be nice. That patience, compassion, kindness, it flows out of you. It's like a rain cloud that it just showers because it's full. So I don't believe this practice is narcissistic. I believe it's our responsibility to fill that cup. As much as there is suffering and injustice in the world, when you meet that suffering and injustice from anger and from blame and rage, you will have a certain degree of effectiveness. If you can meet that injustice from a place of compassion, you will have a different quality of effectiveness. And we have these wonderful models, these modern-day bodhisattvas, of those who have endured tremendous suffering and have chosen compassion as their path, of Nelson Mandela and Gandhi, Martin Luther King, and many others. There was a directive from the British monarchy saying to British officers in India, forbidding them from having tea with Gandhi, talking with him, or even looking him in the eye, because the compassion and the charisma that flowed from him was so compelling. So, filling your cup. I was sharing a story earlier today of I was leading a retreat just a couple of years ago, and a young mother came to this meditation retreat, and she was very agitated. It was the first time she had left her young children at home, very, very first time. And she had a very powerful retreat, lots of great insights, and left pretty happy camper. I saw her again about 3 months later. And I said, "Wow, you're back." And she said, "Yeah, the retreat was so helpful. I felt such clarity and so much energy flowing out of me. And then it started to fade. I started to get busy, and I could just feel it kind of fade away. And then 2 weeks ago, my girls came up to me, and they said, 'Mommy, you know that place you went to before? We think you might go back there again.'" To have compassion for ourselves. To pause. To fill the cup so it's overflowing. As we've explored this awakening of heart and awakening of mind, as we have seen through the calming of the mind, seeing into the nature of things, seeing into the nature of impermanence, of our relationship to impermanence and the suffering that arises, into the nature of self, as the heart inevitably opens and becomes sensitizes, and we learn how to meet our suffering with an open heart. There is a beautiful phrase from Sri Nisargadatta who says, "Wisdom tells me I am nothing. Compassion tells me I am everything. Between these two, my life flows." So I thought we might close with a short reflection on those qualities. You might sense in the arising of wisdom, the discriminating mind, reflect on these qualities of reality. How this life is filled with impermanence, constant change. To sense how your relationship with change is intimately related to the degree of stress or unease or unsteadiness or suffering that you might experience. To sense if just for a moment the nature of self, of who you are when this tightly bound, identified sense of I and mine softens or falls away. In this attunement to the heart, to compassion, how we are all interrelated. Everything you feel, others feel too. Wisdom tells me I am nothing. Compassion tells me I am everything. Between these two, my life flows. Namaste. Thank you.